listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. We're back from our vacation, and this week, our look at news and events from the Central and South America and Caribbean region focus on Brazil, Mexico, and Nicaragua. We spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, filling us in on what's going on from his vantage point in Managua, Nicaragua. So it looks like a region in crisis from the, my God, shenanigans at best in Brazil that sort of are contextual for the presidential election and the killing still going on in Nicaragua, even though the coup was clearly failed.
Yeah, and we should also talk, if we have time, about the incredible result in Mexico.
Oh, yeah, well, that too, right? That's a big thing, actually.
So, yeah, in Brazil, in some ways, what's happened in Mexico is a counterweight to the crisis of legitimacy in Brazil. Brazil and Mexico are two of the most important countries, obviously, in Latin America and the Caribbean. And in Brazil, you have this extraordinary situation where the judicial system is fighting itself, and they're fighting among themselves about who has jurisdiction in the case of the imprisoned leader, the most popular politician in Brazil, Ignacio Lula da Silva, who's imprisoned on completely baseless charges, and it's extraordinary that he's in jail at all.
Right.
And that's entirely the result of a thorough abuse of the legal powers that were given to a very low-level judge called Sergio Moro to investigate corruption related to the state oil company Petrobras, and also to alleged corruption involving A big Brazilian construction firm, a global Brazilian construction firm called Odebrecht, and other very, very large Brazilian corporations that were alleged to have engaged in illicit payments to politicians over many years. And the Sergio Moro couldn't find any solid proof against Lula. What he depended on was coercing in the most obvious way people that had been caught up in the investigation who were involved in corruption, and he put pressure on them to implicate Lula, and without success. But on the basis of without success in terms of real evidence, but on the basis of their say so, these kind of people that he'd coerced into giving a witness against Lula, just on the basis of their hearsay testimony, he was able to implicate Lula in his investigation. And because the Brazilian judicial system is hopelessly politicized, he was able to get judges at an appeal court level to confirm that his judgment against Lula. Mm. And so now Lula's lawyers have been fighting that with a series of writs of habeas corpus. They managed to get the jurisdiction changed from the original jurisdiction that confirmed the lower level sentence against Lula. And in this new jurisdiction on Saturday, one of the judges in the appeal court in that jurisdiction, you have to remember that Brazil's a huge country. Now, I'm well over 200 million people. And so in the new jurisdiction, one of the judges in that jurisdiction at the appeal court level accepted the writ of habeas corpus and ordered Lula to be released on Saturday or Sunday? I forget.
It's weekend.
Over the weekend, anyway. And then the original low-level judge, Sergio Moro, who was furious about that, he happened to be on vacation at the time, but he managed to somehow communicate with the president of the court of the judge that set Lula free. And that president said, no, we can't do that. Lula has to stay in jail. So you had this extraordinary situation where from one hour to the next, legal moves were being made by very high-level judges for and against Lula's liberation. And in the end, he ended up staying in jail. But that it's not even clear how long that will last. Hmm. But the fundamental thing is that this crisis has shown up the Brazilian judicial system is as much in crisis as its political system. And its political system has been, the legitimacy of its political system has been called fundamentally into question ever since the overthrow of Dilma Rousseff as the country's legitimate president in very questionable proceedings in the Brazilian Congress. And now this latest crisis involving conflicting judicial moves to set free Inácio Lula da Silva has called into question very, very clearly the legitimacy of Brazil's judicial system.
Yeah.
And in that context, Don, you have to remember that you have very influential retired generals in the Brazilian armed forces saying, in the most shameless way, saying the army must intervene in order to protect the Constitution. And what do they mean by that? They mean the army must intervene to ensure that the right wing prevail.
Right. In other words, the army must intervene to protect Brazil from the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we go back to the removal of Dilma Rousseff through a, you can't even call it a constitutional coup, more the judicial coup that removed Dilma Rousseff from office back until, when was this, back in August of 2016, I guess, almost 2 years already. Not only was there not a crime involved, she wasn't even charged with a crime. She was charged with some kind of bookkeeping problem, posting money that was legitimately, appropriated and applied. In other words, it's a valid purpose to use this money for housing for poor people, and it was spent on housing for poor people,
right.
But they put it in the wrong column or something for accounting to the liking of some members of Congress, and they used that as a basis to remove her from office, even though she had just been elected, re-elected. Yeah. And so, the legitimacy of the system took quite a blow there, where you end up with her successor being exposed as one of the most corrupt people in Brazil, the opinion of the masses of people in Brazil obviously resting there, since Temer's had an approval rating now for more than a year of 2-4% maximum.
Yeah.
So that is certainly a marker of the level of legitimacy with which the people of Brazil hold the current government. And now this kind of shenanigans, you have to ask yourself, will whatever happens in the next election survive, those kinds of machinations, or is there going to be some kind of popular uprising?
Well, yeah, and the thing is that, and in the background, as I said earlier, you have the army threatening a military intervention to make sure that the right wing get what they want.
Right.
And if that isn't a crisis of legitimacy, I don't know what is.
That's right.
So then, and if you look at elsewhere, in Ecuador, this same judicialization of politics that has bedeviled Argentina, Brazil, and other countries, has now claimed as another of its victims, former President Rafael Correa.
Yeah.
Who's being accused by some right-wing judge in Ecuador's judicial system
of kidnapping.
Of being involved in a kidnapping.
I know, it's ridiculous.
And it's just so ridiculous. And how does all this work? Well, it works on the basis of pressuring witnesses already caught up in other cases to implicate political targets, and then using the legal figure of conspiracy as a kind of catch-all accusation in which to give some semblance of verisimilitude to the charges against the political target, in this case, Rafael Correa.
Doesn't it sound familiar? Only here in the United States now, they don't even have to prove conspiracy. Now it's collusion. But what they've done is they cast a wide net. Let's look at all of the communications of everybody that ever uttered the words Donald Trump. See if we can prosecute them for anything. Oh, you stiffed the paper boy. You owe the waiter at the local restaurant 2 years worth of tips. Whatever it is, we're putting you in prison unless you tell us that you have you saw Donald Trump have sex with a goat or whatever it is that they're trying to get out. And that's the kind of stuff prosecutors do. But it's almost a theater of the absurd at this point.
Yeah, you very much so, and it shows that. All this, that in itself shows how ridiculous all these theories, these people who theorize about a conservative restoration in Latin America.
Right.
And it is nonsense, because the undercurrent of popular feeling is very much in favor of the kinds of policies advocated by Rafael Correa, Lula da Silva, Dilma Rousseff, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina, all these popular leaders, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua.
Right.
And now the absurdity of this claim that there's some kind of legitimate right-wing resurgence in Latin America has been shown up for the nonsense that it is with the magnificent victory of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in the Mexico's presidential elections, and not just his victory, but the victory of his Moreno party across the board in the legislature, in the municipal elections, in the governorship elections, and his Moreno party won a stunning victory. Certainly in Mexico's history, an absolutely unprecedented victory in terms of a political breakthrough.
Yeah, this is something like in the United States, like, you know, if the Greens or Libertarians or someone wanted. In other words, it's a rejection of the institutional parties. It's not just, you know, one or the other of the dominant parties won, and it was a surprise that it was this one this time, but rather something that goes again to the popular assessment of legitimacy of the institutions themselves, that they're willing to look outside of the things that they've been doing, you know, for decades.
Yeah, and in terms of what we're talking about with reference to Brazil, I mean, the legitimacy of the country's institutions, and that election victory is tremendously important for Mexican society in terms of a validation, a ratification, if you like, of Mexico's the state institutions, its electoral body, the presidency, the legislature. And that all those bodies can now legitimately say that they offer genuine representation of a majority of people in Mexico. Now, what will happen?
Yeah, because that's a question. You know, you mentioned in passing Ecuador. You know, we saw the institutional, you know, reification, ratification, whatever, of Correa's governance by the person that he chose, basically, that he endorsed, rather, being elected, promising to run on this essentially the same platform, promising to govern on essentially the same platform, and then once elected, doing a complete about-face and governing from the right. And so, you know, that was with a well-established, you know, institutional base for, you know, a left-wing government in Ecuador. Of course, that doesn't exist at the moment in Mexico, so it's going to be it's going to be interesting in any event to watch what actually happens as opposed to what people expect to happen.
Yeah, I think all the signs are that López Obrador, as president, is going to try and fulfill his electoral commitments, and he's going to try and stabilize the Mexico's internal economy, especially its agricultural economy that has been so badly affected ever since 1994 by the North American Free Trade Agreement. But at the same time, he's also saying that he's going to respect that agreement. So, I mean, it's difficult to see how, and one can imagine policies that he might be able to take and implement in support of small and medium-sized farmers that are the backbone of Mexico's agricultural economy, as they are in most countries, of course.
Right.
But, there are promising signs, like, for example, he's agreed to implement the agreements that were reached under previous governments with the Zapatistas, and that were never implemented. And he's saying that he will implement those agreements. So that's promising. And as we mentioned in our previous conversation, and he's likely to continue to develop Mexico's relationship with Asian countries, in particular China, of course, but not just China.
Right.
He's likely to try and develop the relationship, because Mexico is a part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's now being implemented without the United States. It'll be interesting to see how that develops. And then at a regional level, he won't be as aggressive. I mean, it's almost certain that he won't be as aggressive as Peña Nieto has been in the regional assault on Venezuela, for example. And he's likely to be much more sympathetic to Cuba than Peña Nieto was, just in terms of foreign relations. How he'll manage the issue of immigration with the administration of President Donald Trump, and that's another thing that remains to be seen, but it's something that during the campaign, he took a strong position on. In favor of doing everything possible to support not just Mexican, but Latin American immigrants in general in the United States. Right. So let's see what happens about that.
I mean, you've got a few gears that spin there, too. Just like with Trump, where you're talking on the one hand about NAFTA. You know, Trump had promised to renegotiate NAFTA, you know, to abrogate NAFTA, whatever. And, you know, essentially you have both of them saying on the one hand, NAFTA bad, and on the other hand, NAFTA good. NAFTA needs to be changed. I mean, there's a consensus. There's certainly a point of introduction from Mexico's side to renegotiate NAFTA also to try to address, you know, the destruction essentially of the, you know, small scale and medium scale farming agricultural sector in Mexico, and these things are obviously related both to the fact of migration. In other words, one of the drivers of migration from Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America was the devastation of the small scale agricultural sector in favor of American agribusiness, largely enabled but not exclusively enabled by NAFTA. So, you know, revisiting that, you're kind of revisiting the whole thing holistically anyway. And so it seems that it may not necessarily be contradictory for him to be taking both positions, even though when Trump took both positions here, people said the same thing, that it was a contradiction. But if you look at the big picture, it's not. It's really a whole cloth.
Right. And of course, the main issue that López Obrador has committed himself to changing in Mexico is the all-pervasive culture of corruption.
Yeah.
But who knows how successful he'll be with that.
I mean, not like narco-mafia corruption and, U.S. DEA, drug lord corruption and et cetera. The people disappearing and being murdered in the streets corruption.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he handles what remains of the investigation into the 43 students disappeared in Ayotzinapa. When was it? 3 years ago now?
Yeah, it's not just that. You know, let's think about the fact that when they were looking for them, every time they dug a hole somewhere to see if they were buried there, they found somebody that was buried, and they had to do a whole lot of work. So presumably a real truth and reconciliation effort would involve disposing of all of those cases, not just the 43.
Yeah, and it's difficult to see, certainly in the 4 years that he has available to him, it's difficult to see how López Obrador is going to be able to cope with the mountain of difficulties that Mexican society is having to cope with.
Right. A lot of problems to deal with there, for sure.
So then, and also... In that victory is relevant to events here in Nicaragua. The situation here in Nicaragua has been one that has had an it's really shown up the extraordinary level of control that corporate and alternative media have over people's perceptions, because the reality that's been presented in the media, in Western media across the board, corporate alternative media across the board, has been that the Nicaraguan government has been guilty of extremely violent repression, and that Daniel Ortega's presidency has lost all legitimacy. And if you look at the events over the last month, last 2-3 weeks, and that has been shown to be a completely false reading of the situation. Now, the most important component of the crisis has been Daniel Ortega's attempts to negotiate a solution with an opposition that don't want to negotiate, because they believed that they had sufficient control of the situation on the streets via their extremely violent activists and supporters operating roadblocks that were strangling the Nicaraguan economy. The Nicaraguan opposition didn't want to negotiate, and it was only as a result of an intervention by the Papal Nuncio, the representative of the Vatican, who took part in the last serious round of talks, that they agreed in principle even to dismantle the roadblocks. Mm. But they agreed that, and then immediately reneged on that agreement, saying that they wouldn't. Right. So the government was then faced with a situation in which the great majority of the population wanted the roadblocks dismantled because of the economic damage it was causing to everybody. You know, people were in a situation where A lot of people, perhaps not the majority, but a very significant minority, work in the informal economy, and they depend on their work from day to day in order to generate income.
Right.
And the roadblocks were preventing them from working, so their families were literally going hungry.
Then you have also the actual supplies of the stores and everything. I mean, the milk travels over the roads, the vegetables travel over the roads, and if these things are not able to get past the roadblock, then they're not going to be in the store when people go there.
Yeah, so what the government did was it set out to negotiate locally at a local level to try and dismantle the roadblocks, and where they couldn't successfully achieve a negotiated agreement, they sent in the police, supported by local community, members from the local community, to dismantle the roadblocks. And they were very successful doing that up here in northern Nicaragua, with very, very few casualties. But then over the weekend, they had to deal with the core kind of shock forces that the opposition had mobilized, in particular in Masaya. But they'd withdrawn from the city of Masaya, which is just south of Managua, and they concentrated themselves in an area of a department called Carazo, around a city called Jinotepe and another city called Duriamba. And in those areas, they had kidnapped, essentially, around 400 truck drivers, the big tractor-trailer trucks that are called furgones here in Nicaragua. And those trucks belonged to businesses from across Central America, as far away as Panama, Guatemala.
Right.
I think there were even some Mexicans being held kidnapped by the opposition activists, who were all heavily armed. And so in the previous week, the El Salvadoran ambassador, who is the kind of representative of the Central American ambassadors, he's the one with it serves as their spokesperson. And he wrote to various bodies involved in the conflict, asking them to use their good offices to free the 400 truck drivers from across Central America and Mexico who were trapped there by opposition activists. And nothing happened. And a delegation went to talk to the activists, and they told them to get lost. And so the government over the weekend was forced to act in order to free these 400 truck drivers and their vehicles that had been trapped for over a month by opposition activists, who explicitly said that the reason that they were kidnapped, they were holding these drivers kidnapped, was as leverage to get to in favor of their political demands against the government.
They call that terrorism in most courts, but yeah.
Yeah, right. So the government took action over the weekend. It looks as though there have been between 10 and 14 deaths, and maybe a couple of dozen injured. We're not sure of the figures yet, including various police officers. But the trucks have been freed, and they're now on their way home to their respective destinations. And but that incident has really cut the legitimacy away from under the whatever political demands the opposition were making, and it's shown up the human rights organizations to be complete phonies, because they in the case there are three human rights organizations principally involved locally, and they feed their disinformation, misinformation, and downright lies into the Inter-American system,
right.
Where their version of events has been taken as given by the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights.
Mm.
But as now this latest incident has shown up the Inter-American Commission to be hopelessly biased against the rights of ordinary people, not just in Nicaragua, but across the region. So it remains to be seen how the political fallout of all this is going to pan out. But one of the things that happened over the weekend at the same time was an absolutely massive demonstration of support for the government from people just in Managua, the streets of Managua overflowed with people supporting the government. Mm. You know, and you're talking about probably figures into the hundreds of thousands. And so that too is another nail in the coffin of the political opposition's attempted coup, because that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, right.
What they tried to do was the political opposition in Nicaragua have consistently failed over the last 10 years to mount a viable electoral challenge to the Sandinista government led by Daniel Ortega. And so what they've done now, 10 years on, 11 years on from the inauguration of President Ortega back in January 2007, is stage a very violent coup in which the human rights organizations have played a key role by trying to claim that over 200 deaths can all be laid at the door of the government.
Yep.
But now the analysis of all those claims have shown that no more than about 50, 51, maximum 56 of the people who have died over the last 3 months can legitimately be claimed to be government protesters. Right. And the great majority are either government supporters or people, just passers-by.
Innocent bystanders, right. And that's, you know, that's the nature of this kind of action backed by the United States around the world, as we've seen from the Maidan to Damascus and, you know, all these other places. And you know, I'd like to pick up on this point next week, because I'd like to incorporate the media blitz that goes on, including discussing how even the left press here has been portraying this, as opposed to what you've actually seen on the ground. So, Tony, we'll pick it up there next week, unless something else happens that requires our attention first. And I thank you for your time, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
The same.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The Arab Spring began with high hopes. But with 7 years on, it turned the Middle East into an open wound. What went so wrong, and what is next for the region? Well, I asked the former president of Tunisia where the wave of revolts started, Mr. Moncef Marzouki.
7 years after the people of the Middle East took to the streets, demanding transparency, democracy, and inclusion, the region is awash with fanaticism, anarchy, and bloodshed. Are popular movements just doomed to fail in the Arab world? Has the Arab Spring become the ultimate antidote against revolutions? Or will another wave of uprisings engulf the region once again?
Moncef Marzouki, the former president of Tunisia, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us. Now, Mr. Marzouki, 7 years ago, the Arab Spring infected the Middle East with hope that popular uprisings would get rid of dictators and usher in an era of prosperity. We have now only one success story out of many. Why has Tunisia managed to make this work so far, but no one else?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for this invitation. Of course, here in Tunisia, we are extremely sorry for what happened in countries like Syria, like Yemen, Libya, even in Egypt. I think it's really a catastrophe that just because these people wanted to be free, you know what happened to the Syrian people, you know what happened to the Libyan people, etc. As for Tunisia is concerned, I can say that, well, we are, of course, very, very proud because we have achieved a peaceful and democratic revolution. But, you know, we are still, we have a lot of problem. We are tackling a lot of problem. We didn't solve all our problems. So I wouldn't talk about success story. I would talk about a half success story. And I am very often asked why Tunisia is so different. In fact, if we have this small success, I can say it has nothing to do with the fact that we are smarter or we are different than Syrian or Libyan. It has to do with the very structure of the Tunisian society. I can say that Tunisia is lucky because you know that we are a middle-class society, well-educated society. We have a very strong civil society for many decades. Also, we are a small country. We don't have oil. We don't have, so we don't attract greed of superpowers or so forth. And we are also a modern country. This is very specific to our history.
You were Tunisia's first president after the revolution. What was the biggest challenge for you then? I mean, do you feel you have fulfilled the protesters' demands and dreams?
One of the main important reasons for the revolution was the high rate of unemployment, high rate of corruption, high rate employment among graduates. And I can say that if we consider this objective, we didn't achieve much. We still have a corrupt society. We still have corruption is everywhere in our society. We still have high rate of unemployment, and we still have a lot of bitterness, especially in the hinterland. So I would say that our success story is a half success story once again, because we have achieved the political gain, the political objective, but we didn't succeed in achieving the economic goals.
So I heard you say that you had nightmares back then, that there will be another revolution within the revolution. Was it hard for you to prevent another uprising from breaking out?
Well, I hope that we could tackle the huge challenges we are facing currently. Once again, we are just facing economic problems. If we can, if Tunisia can move forward, if Tunisia in the next election, for instance, could stay on the track, stay as a democratic state and improve the economic situation, I think we can probably improve the situation as a whole. And I think Tunisian people is a wise people, is a moderate people, and I can hope that we will not have to resort to a new revolution. But if the economic situation would worsen again and again and again, I'm afraid that people would say, hey, it's okay, we are very impressed by the fact that we have freedom of expression, freedom of association, but it's not enough. We want to eat. And so I would be afraid that probably they would be more interested in some autocratic regime that could bring social development. But the problem is that we have had this kind of regime for more than two decades, I think, what we call the strong regime with the dictator and etc. But it didn't bring social and economic improvement. The people of Tunisia has to understand the link between democracy and social development. And this link is not yet well understood.
Like you said, there's corruption. Tunisian unemployment rates are high. Finances are in disarray. The tourism industry is threatened by terrorism. I mean, it's not that much better than under the former dictatorship, right? So how can you explain to young people what this was all really for if they don't see much difference?
Well, first of all, they see difference because for the first time, Tunisians live, they don't live under fear, because under the dictatorship, the situation was, psychological situation of the people was extremely, extremely bad. I think Tunisians were very afraid of the secret police. Tunisians were very afraid of everything. And they used it to feel ashamed and of being just subject to the dictatorship and corrupt dictatorship. So I think they see the difference, and they are. This is why I think they would never accept the comeback of the dictatorship, even if we have this economic problem. But all Tunisians know that, in fact, if you have had this revolution, it's not because, well, the people didn't want, nobody, would take to the street just because he's angry, or people have taken to the street because they were obliged to, because there are, Tunisia would no longer accept to live under this high level of repression, the high level of contempt, the high level of poverty, etc., etc. So, in fact, the main responsible for the revolution, I would say, it is the dictatorship. It's the same thing in Syria. If the Syrian people, took to the street, it It was only and because of the Syrian regime. And it was the same thing in Libya, in Egypt. You cannot, you know, you cannot say to the people, look, be very careful, because if you revolt, then you would have, you would be punished and punished. So people would not accept this kind of blackmail, you know. If we come back to the same regime with the same problem, with the same disease, the outcome would be a new revolution one time or another. It's just a matter of time.
There are street rallies in Tunisia and people are setting themselves on fire, just like in 2011, but with less restrictions on dissent, with free public discourse, with elections. Will the discontent just dissipate away, or is it putting real pressure on Tunisian politicians?
Yes, of course, there is a huge, for the first time in, here in Tunisia, and this is because of the revolution, of course, we have a public opinion. And the public opinion is now playing an important role, you know, to put the pressure on politicians to improve their way of behaving. And, you know, when you have, I think it's very important for a country like ours that people become really citizens, because before the dictate, before the revolution, they were just subject to the dictatorship. Now, currently, they are citizens and they are free, and they are proud of being free. And they are, for the first time, once again, we have a public opinion, and the politician, every politician, is now very aware of the fact that he is well watched by the by this public opinion, by the youth, by social media, etc., etc. And this is our, I would say, this is our main game from the revolution. That for the first time, this country, we are free people, and we are proud of being free people. And
so, sorry to interrupt, but you've just said it. You've just said it. We're free people. Does the fact that you're free people and people are able to speak their minds freely mean that there is a less chance of a revolution because they can say whatever they want?
Yes, but, you know, this freedom is mainly used to fight against the main problem that led to the revolution, which is corruption. Our main problem in this country and all the Arab country is corruption. It's the fact that we have a corrupt elite, and this corrupt elite uses to use the state for its own benefit. For the first time in our history, in 3,000 years in history in Tunisia, we have a public opinion. We have people watching what's happening within the state, watching the level of corruption.
But if you're saying you have public opinion and people watching the politicians, that means that there is less pressure on politicians because there is no danger of revolution.
Yeah.
So politicians can just continue and do whatever they want because there is no pressure, because there's no fear of a revolution anymore.
No, but we are going to have elections, and everybody know that election now had nothing to do with the elections before the revolution. So this also is kind of pressure. But you know, you cannot change the situation from overnight. We have to be patient. We need some more time. But I think as far as Tunisia is now a democratic state, I think we will stick to this new freedom, and we will not give up. Look to the situation in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, and so forth. You would see that people are still fighting for their freedom. They didn't give up, even with the high amount of blood and the high amount of repression of violence by the counter revolution. People are still fighting for their freedom, and this is the new phenomenon in this Arab world. That no matter what the old regime would do, the people would fight for their freedom, and this is very new, and this is very very promising.
All right, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Moncef Marzouki, the former president of Tunisia, discussing the legacy of the Arab Spring 7 years after it broke out. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Moncef Marzouki, the former president of Tunisia, talking about the triumphs and disasters of the Arab Spring revolutions. So talking about the Arab Spring in the region as a whole, The uprisings can't be traced to just Mubarak or Gaddafi or Saleh, since they happened in so many countries at once. But is it fair to bundle all these revolts together? I mean, surely the different Arab states had different reasons for the uprisings, or did they not?
Well, I think that we have had the same problem everywhere. The same problem is, once again, a dictatorship, a harsh dictatorship with massive human rights violation. All this, you know, all those human rights violations, in fact, they were hiding the most important problem, which is corruption. The huge amount of money that have been spent by the local elites everywhere in the Arab world. And this was unacceptable, especially for the new generation. Because what the Arab leaders didn't understand, that they are facing a new generation. I call it the E-generation. This generation of young people, well-educated, well-informed, extremely aware of everything happening in the world, etc., being part of this social network, international social network, etc. This E-generation has nothing to do with the older generation, my generation, for instance, where you have people who are not educated, who could accept everything. You know, I don't like the word Arab Spring. I always talk about the Arab volcanoes or the Arab earthquake. What happened in 2011 was just the first outburst of the volcanoes. And even now, you can be quite sure that you will have a new eruption of volcanoes everywhere if the local elite don't tackle this problem of corruption of social justice.
So the Libyan and Syrian cases led to all-out war. And talking specifically about Libya now, the Gaddafi regime managed to uphold the tribal power balance in the country. With Gaddafi gone, the tribes have gone to war. Do you think it's irresponsible to start a revolt without thinking about how to keep the country together after the revolt? Is it worse removing the dictator but losing the country in the process?
Yes, well, this is exactly what many people would say everywhere. But I can respond to this. Who is responsible of the situation of Libya? I think this Gaddafi was head of state for more than four decades. Why didn't he do everything, you know, to promote education, to promote social justice, etc., etc.? Imagine that this dictator has done this. Has promoted, I would say, the minimum of the democracy, the minimum of social justice, the minimum of... I think that probably Libya would be now one of the richest and the most stable country in the region. But this didn't happen. So once again, what's happened now in Libya, the outbreak of the revolution and the aftermath of the revolution, it's the responsibility of Gaddafi. Exactly, it's the responsibility of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. It's the responsibility of the dictatorship in Tunisia. I think imagine that all those dictators behaved differently. Imagine that in Syria, for instance, Bashar al-Assad has accepted the minimum of freedoms, the minimum of social justice. You wouldn't have this catastrophe here in Syria.
Okay, so but he didn't. But we're talking right now about things that didn't happen. We're talking about things that didn't happen and we can't change. My question is, with the things standing the way they stand right now, is it worse losing a country by removing a dictator?
Yes, but the answer would be, look, I would say to every country now living under dictatorship, look, imagine what would happen if you get rid of the dictatorship. So please accept repression. So please accept corruption. So please accept everything. So please accept, because look, it would be worse if you don't, if you move forward, if you ask, if you stand for your dignity or for your rights. You cannot talk to people like this. You cannot imagine now any country living under harsh dictatorship and say, Be careful, because if you revolt, you would, your fate would be worse. No, you cannot talk to the people like this. You have to talk to the lesson would be to talk to the dictators everywhere, to tell them, look, you have to do something for your country, because if you don't, you can have a destruction of your regime, but also the destruction of your people, of your country. This is what should be said to the dictator and not to the people. This should be the lesson of the Arab Spring.
Yeah, do you think dictators are listening now?
No, they are not listening, because, you know, a dictator is a dictator. I think he has he listened to anybody. He's convinced that he's right all the time, etc., etc. But, you know, it's once again, when you have a social and economic problem in a country, you cannot blame the people. You must blame the regime, because the regime has the upper hand. When you have the upper hand, you are responsible. You cannot ask the people, you know, to accept you just because it could be worse if you are removed.
So the uprising that led to the Russian Revolution in 1917, it started chaotically, but was quickly settled by the organized underground revolutionary parties. Why didn't the Arab Spring uprisings have an organized political force to lead them and focus them?
Well, because, you know, when you live under dictatorship, the dictator would do everything, you know, to prevent any kind of peaceful organizing, political party or so forth to lead the revolution. Of course, this is what happened in Libya. Gaddafi has done everything, you know, to prevent any kind of organization, whether it was political or just NGOs. And so when he was overthrown, there was a kind of vacuum. And when you have this kind of vacuum, of course, you can have everything. You can have this horrible violence going on just now. Fortunately, in Tunisia, because we have this tradition of being a strong civil society for so many decades before the independence, we were lucky, because we have had this, group of people leading the revolution, and this is why we didn't have this civil war and so forth.
So the Arab Spring protests got a lot of people really excited, and the Western leaders, Western media, local activists, all of them were like up at us. But in the wave of excitement, what happens to the voices of people who didn't want to come out to the streets? For instance, while people in Benghazi wanted Gaddafi out, people in Tripoli were not as excited over the idea. While people in Homs wanted Assad out, people in Aleppo were very skeptical over the proposal. Is it inevitable, ignoring this one side that isn't yelling as loud as the other?
You know, a society, within a society, you have the loser and the winner. The society, you have people who are happy with the regime because they have everything they want from this regime. So it's quite normal that in Syria or in even in Tunisia, you know, people, some part of the population was not very happy with the fall of the dictatorship, because a dictatorship is not just one person and his family that that enjoying life and having a lot of money, etc. You have thousands of people, you know, living very well under a dictatorship. So I can imagine that in Syria, in Iraq, etc.
So do you see the danger of painting everyone who isn't partaking in the revolutionary fever as this government, or you say regime all the time? I mean, you end up presenting them as a faceless mass of people without a voice. I mean, that's how civil wars start.
There is always in a society a majority and a minority. And I can assure you that a big minority were extremely unhappy with the outcome of the Arab Spring. But look, when you have a crisis, an important political crisis like we have had before the outbreak of the revolution, what is the solution? You cannot express your feeling, your will as a majority, because there are no election, no fair election. Then you have to take to the street. You don't have any other solution. You cannot tell the people, look, there are some people who don't agree with you because they are happy with the regime. And you cannot tell them, look, stay quiet because you could have the situation worsen if you revolt, because we are going to, you know, crush you, we are going to kill you, all of you, you are going to burn the country, etc. You cannot tell this to the population. The population would take to the street or would try to express itself, because people can no longer accept the situation where they live. And this is the reality. You have to accept this also.
All right, Mr. Marzouki, thank you very much for this interview. We were talking to Moncef Marzouki, the former president of Tunisia, discussing the impact of the Arab Spring 7 years on in Tunisia and other Arab countries. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.